Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and our producer is Matt Neely. Thank you, Matt, for what you do for Jump in Tucson. And coming up tomorrow, we have General Ted Maxwell will be the host. On Wednesday, Grant Kruger will be here with Food and Politics. And on Thursday, Tom Moulton will be talking about Tucson attractions. I'll return next Friday with business success stories. Jump in Tucson, today's theme is Wonder at the University of Arizona. And this Monday's Wonder program is sponsored by Michael Kasser of Hulualoa Companies. Our first guest today is Dr. Nellie Goetz of the University of Arizona College of Veterinary Medicine. So welcome, Nellie.
Thanks. I really appreciate you having me here today.
So we were talking a little bit about your journey of how you obviously became a doctor of veterinary medicine, and you have a master's degree. But how did you pick veterinary science and veterinary medicine as the path that Nellie was going to take? And then how did you end up at the University of Arizona?
You know, I started off, as a lot of veterinarians do, really wanting to do this since I was little. Mm-hmm. You know, ever since I was a little kid, I was fascinated with animals. I always, you know, tried to bring home the stray things that were running around in the yard. You know, let me get this cat that was outside and bring it in the house, and wanting to bring home anything. Loved horses when I was a kid, was absolutely obsessed with horses. Begged my parents for a horse until finally they leased me a pony one year for Christmas, and that was like the best thing that ever happened to me. And so I kind of got into it from that aspect of it. And
you're the typical kid that asked for a pony for Christmas. I love it.
wanted Santa to bring me a pony. And I got into actually large animal first, and wanted to be a horse surgeon. That's what I was going to do, and that was my sort of dedicated path in life. And picked the college that I wanted to go to based off of that, because they actually had a specific equine pre-vet program. That was in Ohio, and they were pretty strongly affiliated with the Ohio State University. I'm from Massachusetts, so I only jokingly throw the in there.
There you go.
And that's actually where I ended up going to vet school. Kept on that path, thought I was going to do large animal. Actually did a large animal surgery residency, but then switched into small animal, and then found my way into teaching that way.
So what is your specialty then from your degree? Is it small animal, and what is your specialty with them?
So right now, what I mainly do is teach small animal surgery. And so what I did for years was actually teach spay-neuter, which is a really, really important skill, especially for new graduates to be able to do. We've got a lot of overpopulation issues out there, and it's really, really important. It's an important skill for new graduates.
We can talk to our friends at the Humane Society and the Pima County Animal Control, and the overpopulation problem is really a dire situation in many cases. And so this is really, really important. So you said that you got your you were up north a little bit for, doing some teaching and being involved. So tell us about that experience, and then how did you get recruited and jump into the University of Arizona?
Yeah, so I started teaching. My dad actually was a math, science, and social studies teacher for 30 years. So I think that's kind of maybe where the teaching bug started. And I really, really, really enjoyed it. Never pictured myself in academia, but I got into it when I was in North Carolina teaching in a really, really large sort of private practice teaching place. And then I found a job at Midwestern, which is the other vet school that's here in Arizona. I was there for a few years. Didn't quite really click with me, so I left for a few years.
Where is that located? What city?
It's in Glendale.
In Glendale.
Yep. And so I left, and I wasn't sure I was going to go back to academia, but my husband convinced me to apply when U of A opened. You know, they have a really strong focus on having students be day one ready. There's an accelerated program. So most veterinary schools are 4 years. You get summers off, except for when you're in your final year, which is your clinical year. But the University of Arizona does an accelerated 3-year program. So the students go year round. And there's a lot of pros to that. They're able to get done with school faster. It costs less because they're not in school for as long. And it really, being in school consistently, really helps to sort of hammer home a lot of the concepts that we're hoping that stick and really make a lot of sense to them when they become day one ready veterinarians.
More like a medical residency that a medical doctor would do at a hospital. They do their residency to really get hands-on training and apply their learning in the field as they're working. So
it's really consistent, and that just gets repeated over and over and over.
You know, we're going to talk after the break about a unique program that the college is working on. These topics come to me partly from our friend Pam Scott, who's a vice president of communications at the University of Arizona, and she had brought this to my attention of what a unique program this is. We'll talk about the surgical trailer in just a little bit. The college itself has been around about 5 years, I think, or...
Yes, they started in 2020, and we actually graduated our first class last year in 2023.
So I think it is, if I'm not mistaken, one of the newest colleges
on
campus.
It's one of the newest, correct.
Right, and so it's kind of interesting to watch its growth over the last few years of how it's been able to take off and provide so many, you know, there's other colleges on campus, of course, the College of Medicine and so forth. But this unique program to veterinary science is really important to the community, and
absolutely,
as you say, it is the veterinary medicine school in the Arizona now, correct?
Yes, and it's the only land grant school. So Midwestern's a private university,
right?
So being that University of Arizona is a land grant school, it does minimize the amount of tuition that students have to pay versus a private university, which is a really nice option, especially for students that are from the state of Arizona. They get the option to pay in-state tuition, which having less student loans when you get out of school, less debt, is always better for you.
Yeah, this is amazing. And, you know, of course, as a land-grant institution, there's locations of the University of Arizona all over the state of Arizona. So these students get a unique chance to go around and see different places. So we're talking with Nellie Goetz. She is a part of the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Arizona. And we're going to come back in just a little bit and talk about a unique program that's serving rural communities. And we'll kind of get into depth on how that all works and what the college is doing to serve some of the rural populations. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. This is the Monday Wonder segment where we talk about great things happening at the University of Arizona. We'll come back in just a few minutes with the second half and talk about how this rural program works for the community. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson, this Monday edition. You know, our theme on Mondays is wonder at the University of Arizona and the great things that are happening at the U of A. And we're so thankful to Michael Kasser of Halu'uloa Companies, who believes in telling the positive stories that are happening at the University of Arizona. Sometimes we hear just the negative side, and it's nice to hear all the good things and the good work that's happening at the University of Arizona. Our guest for this segment is Dr. Nellie Goetz. She's a veterinarian with the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Arizona. And we talked a little bit about, your journey and how the veterinary college came. Pam Scott gave me a really cool lead on an idea that maybe this is something to talk about. It's the 55-foot trailer that's been converted into a surgical unit that is the beast. It's now traveling around the state, and you've been up to Pinal County. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about this unique idea of taking veterinary medicine on the road.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things that we really try to establish with this program and with our students is that there are communities out there that need our help that are not... The people that are there are not able to bring their animals into the clinic for a variety of reasons. They may have transportation issues. There may be communities that just can't access a veterinary clinic. We have what we call veterinary care deserts, where people are so far away from a veterinary clinic that it's just not possible. They would have to drive two or 3 hours. And especially these days with the prices of gas, it's really difficult for people to make that journey, take time off from work, do things like that, even to get basic preventative care for their pets. And it's a really good opportunity for us to combine care for animals with learning opportunities for students. And so the university was able to get some really generous donations from some amazing donors to allow us to purchase this basically semi-trailer that has been converted to a purpose-built surgical trailer. So it's got four surgery tables. It also has on either end of it, on either end of what's basically the surgery room in the middle, on either end of it, it's got holding kennels. It has the capacity to sterilize the surgical equipment. It has the capacity to, it's also handicap accessible, which I think is amazing that we really are embracing the ability for anybody and everybody to be able to be a part of that care team. It was designed, I actually was a part of the design of that trailer, and we really made sure that it was very, very accessible as possible. And the idea, like I said before, is for it to be able to go out to communities where this care is less accessible. Because it's a big trailer, it isn't the type of smaller trailer that you would take out for like a day at a time.
Right.
It goes out and it kind of sits where it needs to be for a few days at a time, which is actually what we did, as you pointed out, recently when we took it up to one of the shelters in Pinal County. Mm-hmm. So we took it up to Pinal County Animal Control, and we parked it out there, and we did, I believe, 3 days of surgical basically spay neuter and other surgical procedures for the shelter animals up there.
Right.
So
it's a huge 55 foot trailer. Mm-hmm. It's got a slide out, so it increases the size when it's parked. It's got it's like walking, like as a young kid, I remember going to Tucson International Airport and walking up some big steps to get onto the plane. Mm-hmm. On the tarmac. It's kind of got a couple of those, which then begs the question, this is not necessarily for horses and big animals.
Correct.
Because it's raised up off the ground. So so that surgical stuff would still take place in a fixed place where you can bring a horse in.
Correct.
But this is intended for medium to small sized animals.
Companion
mm-hmm. animals. So mm-hmm. everything from a dog or a cat, but it could be what someone would consider birds, all sorts mm-hmm. of
pocket pets, rabbits, guinea pigs, things like that as well.
Right. And so how was this funded? Was this a donation, or was this just part of the mission that the college would invest in this? How did it come about from a financial? Because it's obviously a gorgeous trailer, or surgical unit, mm-hmm. I guess we should call it. So how did that all come about? How did the funding for that come about?
So we actually did seek out donor funding for it, and were able, through a couple of very, very generous donors and also through some corporate donations, to be able to acquire funds not only to purchase the trailer, but also then to continue to fund operation of the trailer, basically. And I do believe that the university also paid for a portion of it as well. So it was kind mm-hmm. of a combined effort.
Right.
So the university realize that the vision of what the trailer is going to do as far as surgical training and help for the community was really important. And then we were able to combine that with donor dollars to make it work.
Yeah, and as a land grant institution, that's the service that one of the services that the university, by statute, being a land grant university, that's one of the things of providing community support across mm-hmm. the state of Arizona is important. So it's a pretty impressive a unit. It's, you know, you can do blood work there. It's got mm-hmm. Tables, sinks, anesthesia machines. It's got monitoring equipment. It's got surgical instruments. Mm-hmm. It's like an actual surgical center on wheels.
It is. It's a pretty high-tech surgical center, too. I've been in many, many different surgical mobile units before, and this is probably one of the most top-of-the-line ones that I've been on.
So for the student who is participating in the veterinary medicine program and they're in this 3-year intensive learning and you know, starting the marathon, and 36 months later they're going to be through the program, what is the experience of a young person who's trying to learn the ropes of veterinary medicine? How would this trailer then give them that baptism mm-hmm. in veterinary medicine?
So the nice thing is that right now we are utilizing it at our one of our locations that's on campus. So it stays in a fixed location all year round when it's not traveling. And the students, when they are in what's called their live animal course in surgery, they all rotate through at least one station on that mobile surgical trailer to be able to do live animal surgery. So before they go out into their clinical year, they all get an experience with instructors, with the surgery and anesthesia instructors, to be able to do live animal surgeries with a 1-to-1 or a 2-to-1 student to instructor ratio, which is an incredibly, incredibly low ratio. And there's actually published research that shows that the lower that ratio is, the better the students learn. And so we try to keep that ratio extremely low. And that's where the trailer comes into their education. So they're able to actually do their surgeries on that trailer. It's pets that come from rescues and shelters in the area. Mm-hmm. So they're providing a service to those rescues, and they're also getting learning out of it.
That's a unique approach, and it's great to have sponsors and others jump in and help with a project like this. Mm-hmm. So if listeners around the state wanted to find out more and, you know, either invite the college to bring the trailer to their facility or just support it in some way and support these students that are trying to learn their craft, where could they find out more information about the college and about the mobile surgical center?
Our website is a fountain of information. And so that would be the first place that I would direct people to. There are lots and lots of links on the College of Veterinary Medicine website to any sort of information that people would be looking for. And there's different places on there that have information about the different aspects of the vet school, and also links to people to contact for more information about certain aspects of it.
You know, we talked about going around the state. What is on the horizon? Is there a surgery trailer 2.2 on the horizon, or what's on the horizon for the college in this first 10 years growth spurt that the college is having? What's on the horizon for the surgical centers and for what students might be able to be exposed to?
There are plans to continue to build relationships around the state and to be able to not only have this trailer be out in the community more, but also potentially have this trailer be involved in also have this trailer be involved in things that have to do with what's called One Health. So that is sort of the intersection of animal health, human health, and environmental health. And so that is a big focus for the veterinary school, something that we're sort of doing a little bit on the ground already with Pima Health Department. But this surgical trailer could be huge in developing that as well. But really being able to have the trailer go out into the community more and having more student involvement in the community, that's the next iteration of what we want to
do. Well, that takes resources, right? In order to get the trailer out there, it takes resources. And there's a lot of focus on finances and stuff at the university right now. So obviously reaching out into the community and asking for some support and some help. How can the average listener jump in, volunteer, or help you in any way? What would be, if you were listening to this now and you wanted to support the program, what would I as a listener do to jump in?
If you were listening right now and you thought that there's a way that you wanted to be able to support the program, honestly, the best thing to do would be to contact probably the development office at the vet school and see if there's a way that you can help financially. Make a donation in some way, see if there's something, there's not a supply need.
Right.
So it's not a situation like that where a lot of humane societies and things, there's supplies that they need. That's not typically an issue for us, but if there's a specific, directed donation or something like that that you'd like to make to be able to support the operation of the surgical trailer or a student scholarship or something of that nature, that would honestly be the best directed way to do it.
We know we need help in that area of scholarships and help in resources and obtaining the resources to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Nelly Goetz, we really appreciate you coming in today and talking about the University of Arizona College of Veterinary Medicine and your initiative on this project. And if you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson, give us a shout at jumpintucson.com. Maybe we can get you on the air as well. You're listening to Jump in Tucson, the Monday University of Arizona Wonder Edition. You're listening to KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley with the Monday Wonder Edition, talking about the good things that are going on in research and good works that are happening at the University of Arizona. Our guest now is Dr. Catherine Jacobs. She is the director for the Center of Climate Adaptation. I said that wrong the first time. Climate Adaptation Science and Solutions, Professor of in Environmental Sciences at the University of Arizona. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks very much.
You know, we had talked about late last year. There was an article that was written that scientists are explaining why the record-shattering 2023 heat has them on edge, and warming may be worsening more so than what we think. But before we get to that, I just wanted to just talk with you a little bit about how you got your calling to be part of climate science and solutions, and how you became the director at the University of Arizona, a little journey from where you started to where you are now.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate you asking. I worked as a water manager for the Arizona Department of Water Resources here in Tucson for 23 years before I became a faculty member at the university. And that's been a bit of a journey, you're right. I helped build the water management system for the state under the Groundwater Management Act. And then after I came to the university, I've been engaged in a lot of big projects, but all of them are related to both climate and water. I got engaged in the National Climate Assessment in the late 1990s and have been looking at the intersection of global warming and the impacts associated with changes in the water cycle for much of the last 20 years since I've been a faculty member. And most of my work has to do with on-the-ground projects, working with water managers and scientists and trying to help translate climate information to help make better decisions.
Well, that's near and dear to my heart. I don't know if you know this, but for the last two mayoral cycles, I ran for mayor of the city of Tucson. And certainly we talk about police and crime and homelessness and roads and all sorts of different things. I call it the sleeper issue, which is not that much of a sleeper issue. The water issue in Arizona as a desert community, but specifically in Tucson with our water table and the CAP, it is a huge issue for us to tackle as residents and leaders in our community. So that work that you've done with water is really impressive.
Well, thank you very much, and I agree with you. It is critical to the future of our city and our state, and honestly, the globe, that we do a better job of managing our resources. Fortunately, Tucson has made lots of investments in that arena, and you know, we're in relatively good shape, but it's still a scary time for water managers generally.
So we're talking with Dr. Catherine Jacobs from the Center for Climate Adaptation and Science and Solutions at the University of Arizona. This segment is being brought to us by our good friend Michael Kasser from Hulualoa Companies, who part of his company is here in Tucson. His other part of his company is in the beautiful islands of Hawaii. And, you know, there's sunshine there pretty much year-round in Hawaii. But I was, in prepping for this, I noticed that NASA and other national organizations said in the last 10 years, from 2014 to 2023, they have noted this is the 10 hottest years that they've measured since they've been measuring. And that's a pretty startling statistic.
Yes, in fact, we've been seeing each decade warming consistently since the 1940s, and that's on average, the global average temperature. But it has actually been accelerating, and certainly 2023 was a very shocking year in many regards. And it's primarily because it was sort of the overlay of a particularly warm ocean cycle with what's going on with the long-term climate trend. And so you get the variability on top of the long-term trend, and that really made this last year very warm.
Right. When we think, you know, novices like me who don't know much about the scientific properties of climate change and so forth, you know, for me, it's the temperature, you know, it's so hot that the ambient temperature in Tucson is, you know, in Phoenix is hotter and hotter. It seems each year, each summer gets just a little bit more toasty. But with 70% of the Earth covered with oceans, one of the big issues is the warming oceans and what's happening to our oceans and how that has affected the global warming. So that's a pretty important part of this research, correct?
Absolutely. It turns out that 90% or so of the heat that is now trapped because of global warming in the atmosphere is actually entering and being stored in the oceans. And so it's sort of like a giant battery to store all that energy that comes from the sun and previously did not get trapped inside of our atmosphere. And so that means that we're going to be feeling the effects of this increased warming well into the future, even if we get our act together and start limiting emissions more dramatically. The oceans do drive the climate and the weather system. And so what happens in the oceans directly affects what's happening on land.
And this does affect human beings because we're talking about incessant heat waves. We can talk about floods, even the floods in California this last week, even though those were caused by an atmospheric river with the previous wildfires and the lack of vegetation on some of those Southern California hills. The mudslides continue. There's droughts throughout parts of the country. And, of course, we've all been witnessing some pretty severe storms over the last few years, of the storms being more fierce and more electric and more damaging over the last decade or so.
Yes, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration keeps track of billion-dollar events, and the number of billion-dollar events in the United States has been increasing over time. This last year was the highest number yet. I think it was 24 billion-dollar climate and weather-related events. And many people think, well, you know, there have always been extremes, but it's now been shown that we're sort of outside the range of normal statistics with these extreme events. They can't be explained except in the context of climate change. And so we're definitely in an era where it's not theoretical that we're experiencing the impacts of climate change. We're observing it weekly and all over the country in a variety of different ways. We see, you know, the tundra melting and loss of snow and ice in Alaska. It's warming incredibly quickly. And then we see these very large wildfires across the West. We see sea level rise and storm surges much higher than they've ever been. In fact, in Maine, they just had the highest they've ever had this last month. A big storm surge. So anyway, it's actually the effects are very visible across the board.
Yeah, last year at this time, Australia was going through a terrible wildfire season, and Chile this past week or so has gone through some massive wildfires that have devastated many populated areas. But also, when wildfires come through and burn down forests and so forth, that takes a while for those to regenerate, and that exacerbates the climate change problem.
It does. It results in mudslides, as you already noted, but also siltation of reservoirs. So when you have a lot of the hillsides burned off, the soil and ash and debris flows down into reservoirs, and then that becomes a water management problem. So these effects do cascade through our systems.
Well, when we come back after the break, let's talk a little bit about the future, what your research looks for, what scientists are worried about as this warming continues, and what we as citizens of the world can do. It'll be an interesting conversation. Our guest is Dr. Catherine Jacobs, the director for the Center of Climate Adaptation and Science and Solutions. And we'll be back in just a minute on Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Monday Wonder Edition, where we talk about wonderful research and good things that are happening at the University of Arizona. Our guest this segment is Dr. Catherine Jacobs. She's the Director for Senate and Climate Adaptation Science and Solutions, Professor in Environmental Science. And, you know, it just takes a little bit. The amount of temperature change can be as little as maybe a quarter of a degree, but yet that has, over the period of time of, say, 4, 5, 6, 10 years, that's a significant increase. If we increase annually that in the course of a decade, we're starting to push the envelope a little, are we not?
Sure, and I think it's very misleading to think about the impacts of climate change in terms of quarters of degrees and so forth, because what we're really talking about is a global average temperature, right. And nobody's actually experiencing the global average. They're experiencing way over or way under generally. And so what we might see is 4 or 5 degrees of increase in temperature in a summer heat wave, well beyond what could be considered normal, as opposed to a quarter of a degree. And in addition, the main thing that we're seeing is with all this additional energy stored in the atmosphere and in the oceans is an extreme events increase. So it's not just how we experience these small things, but really intense hurricanes, intense wildfires. These are not sort of changes in average conditions, but changes in extremes. And that's the part that people are now finally starting to understand, is it isn't about small changes in degrees. It's actually about broad impacts that have to do with so much more energy in the Earth's atmosphere.
And scientists would agree that much of this is human-caused climate change, but it's also combined with phenomena like the El Nino in the Pacific Ocean and other things. But combined, this is creating ocean temperatures to rise and deep waters. The top of the water is maybe warmer down a few extra feet or so than what it normally is, and that's affecting coral reefs and all sorts of things in the oceans.
Yes, we are seeing big temperature changes actually in the oceans, including the very deep oceans, because there is ocean circulation. We're also seeing ice melting and a lot more, and a lot of changes in ocean circulation because of ice melt. So there's a lot of changes going on, and people are studying all of these things and how they're linked to climate change. But you're absolutely right. Variability, which is, you know, 1 year it's warmer, 1 year it's cooler, that kind of thing is going to continue to happen. And so, you know, if it happens to snow in May, that does not mean we're not having climate change. It's just, you know, variability in the system, which continues to happen on top of this long-term trend. And many people seem to have difficulty grasping that and get really excited if it happens to be extremely cold one winter. But that really doesn't mean that on average the globe isn't warming.
So you would say that this is a concern for scientists around the world, and they are from many different countries who are looking at these problems. But Tucson and the University of Arizona, it's a good epicenter for what you're doing in your department and in your center, and what you are contributing and the University of Arizona is contributing to this study.
Yes, I would say we have one of the largest aggregations of faculty members who are focused on climate adaptation, which is managing the risk associated with climate change. We do a fair amount of climate science at the University of Arizona and modeling and so forth, but we do a lot of work in helping people understand the effects of climate change, whether it's, you know, from a legal perspective or the hydrology perspective, environmental sciences. There's a whole array of people. In fact, around 60 faculty members at the university are actively engaged in climate adaptation. And so we think that's a major center of strength for the university.
And getting some worldwide acclaim for that as well, of your center and the research that's going on at the U of A is being widely recognized. And, you know, as a person who's listening to this, and, you know, how can they jump in and get engaged in the process? Obviously, each of us has our own contributions to our environment and what we do. And we talk a lot about simple little things that individuals can do. This is obviously a global problem. This is obviously a societal problem, large government initiatives that have to be implemented. But what can an individual do, and how can they get some information to contribute their part in this, to try and maybe mitigate some of this global warming?
Well, thank you very much for focusing on the solutions side of this discussion, because honestly, it does get a bit depressing to focus primarily on the problems. And the whole reason that my center is called the Center for Climate Adaptation Science and Solutions is that we are looking for ways that individuals can make a difference and how different government programs might be able to help. I've worked a lot on the Colorado River. I've worked on groundwater management in Arizona. I've worked more broadly nationally and internationally looking at water-related solutions in particular. But we also look at it from the perspective of indigenous resilience and helping tribes be better prepared to deal with these issues. We have a broad array of forest management challenges that are facing us. I'm working on a big project across all three Arizona universities, trying to identify new sources of water that could be captured within the water cycle that would not affect our existing water supplies, but bring new sources to certain watersheds. So there's a big array of opportunity. Individuals can certainly check our website, which is the Center for Climate Adaptation Science and Solutions. We have a list of experts, an expertise directory, and we're happy to answer questions if people want to be connected to people who have particular kinds of solutions in agriculture or forestry or whatever your interest might be.
Are there any presentations or anything that the public can attend in the coming months or year or so that you're planning where an individual might be able to stop in and get some more in-person?
Absolutely. Yes. My center is within a broader array of environmental activities called the Arizona Institute for Resilience. And we have around 16 centers and programs. You definitely should check the website for the Arizona Institute for Resilience. It does have events that are open to the public that are visible all the time. There's also a listserv for a newsletter called The Dirt. And then we also, within my center, have a listserv for people who are interested in coming to our events. We have events all the time. So definitely check those websites, and we're happy to put you actively on a listserv to contact you when there's events happening.
For you personally, as a scientist and as a researcher, it can be a little depressing perhaps working and seeing that there's this huge problem facing humanity and how you're documenting that with your fellow scientists. But also there's some hope, isn't there? There's some hope that the human condition can do some things collectively and individually that might mitigate some of this. And that's that solutions aspect of what you're talking about.
Yes, I'm convinced that we can solve these problems. The problems are solvable, and we have all the tools. The problem is we don't have the political will to make those difficult decisions. And that's a really hard place to be, because we need our elected officials to stand up and vote for our children and grandchildren. That's really how I see it. I'm in a group called Science Moms, and we're really interested in seeing better decisions made on behalf of future generations.
Well, Dr. Catherine Jacobs, we thank you for joining us today from the University of Arizona. This is Jump in Tucson and Wonder Edition, talking about the great things happening at the University of Arizona. Thanks for listening to Jump in Tucson.